It's Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll learn why the city of Seymour is considered the birthplace of the hamburger.
But first, we're talking about what some are calling the biggest religious freedom case the Supreme Court has seen in the last 50 years.
At issue is whether or not the town of Greece in upstate New York can open their monthly town hall meeting with a Christian prayer. This week, members of the U.S. Senate and House of Representatives, most of them Republican, filed briefs with the High Court in support of relaxing the laws on prayers at government meetings.
Lawyers for the Obama administration have also petitioned the court on behalf of the town. The U.S. Second Circuit Court of Appeals ruled the town's prayer policy endorses a Christian point of view, making it unconstitutional.
The Supreme Court agreed to hear an appeal this fall. Derek Hicks is with us now. He's assistant professor of religion and culture at Wake Forest University's School of Divinity. He's the author of Reclaiming Spirit of the Black Faith Tradition. Derek, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So the Supreme Court's going to take a look on this. If they rule in favor, in the town's favor, allow prayers before the government meetings, what are the implications of that?
Well, the implications religiously for this country are broad and sweeping, it would seem to me. On some level, what this issue is about is how the United States as a nation has utilized religion and the impact of religious faith and culture on American life, American culture, and American politics. So this debate, on some level, forces us to contend yet again or perpetually with whether or not the United States was founded as a Christian nation. And here I'm reminded of the great work co-authored by Nathan Hatch, who's actually the president of Wake Forest University, along with Mark Knoll and George Marsden, entitled The Search for a Christian America, that while Christian values have been absent from American history and culture, there have been some Christian influences. And so we've been debating for years the extent of those Christian influences.
Well, and then there's always a challenge to this sort of thing by people often who aren't Christian. Jewish or atheist saying, hey, if you do this, we're left out. How does that fit in?
Right. I think the takeaway from this, or at least the starting point of this cultural and political conversation, really centers on those two sides. That on one side, on one level of this, the issue is driven in part by assumptions regarding the impact of one particular religion, in this case Christianity, on the United States. So for the Christian, for those who would be proponents of Christianity and its influence on our culture and society, it is for them a confirmation of the historical idea, some would argue the historical myth, that this is, in fact, a Christian nation. For them, it is an issue of religious freedom in the sense that they are practicing the religion of, or at least primarily endorsed by, the nation state. But for those who you mentioned, the non-Christian, the atheist, the Jewish adherent, the Muslim adherent, such freedoms are at the heart of the issue, because for them, this debate does not open the door for further religious freedom and tolerance. Rather, it closes the door for any religious practices that are not Christian. This would be kind of a prima facie violation of the First Amendment ban on the quote-unquote establishment of religion. So for them, and especially with respect to the separation of church and state, rather than simply narrowing the distance between the nation state and organized religion, one religion, in this case Christianity, becomes perched, as it were, on top of the nation state in matters of law, justice, or adjudication, again, in violation of the First Amendment. So this is a very significant issue.
But looking at it at this particular thing, it's, you know, a monthly town meeting, or in another case, it might be a graduation prayer or something like that. These are pretty small things. Do we put too much weight on them? Why do they become such a hot button issue?
Right. I'm not so sure that we put too much weight on them, especially given the diversity of religious expression in our country, right? That on some level, what this speaks, in this particular case, what it spoke to a person of Jewish faith and an atheist, is it revealed to them an endorsement of one religion over other religions, especially when we're talking about, in some cases, inviting in a Christian minister to pray the prayer. I'm sure I'm not sure if that was in this case, but in another case, in a similar case. But the issue for them becomes, okay, who rules the day as it were, as it relates to religious freedom here? And it still seems, even though the White House has said this is not considered an endorsement, I think that's a slippery slope, or an endorsement of one religion over others. I think that's a slippery slope, because for those who are not Christian, it still seems to them to be not just an endorsement, but a forcing of their ideals to align with Christian norms and values.
From the Christian side, they're saying, we are a community that is maybe mostly predominantly Christian. We want to, you know, exercise our personal beliefs, acknowledge the identity of our Christian faith, not just at home, not just at church, but in a public setting like a government meeting, like a graduation. Are we saying no to them?
Well, that becomes the sticky issue, especially when you mention a government meeting. If, in fact, we are talking about meetings or gatherings that are endorsed by the state, by the nation state, we run the risk of tampering with the whole First Amendment issue of not endorsing one religion over another. And so for them, it becomes an issue of whether or not their ideals, their norms, given that this is a majority Christian nation, are being given the type of sway they feel it should be. And I think that's a logical debate. I think it's a worthy debate and conversation to have. But at the heart of this issue is whether or not the government is in play in kind of offering normative ideas around religion, in this case around Christianity, and that's a debate that needs to be discussed.
Now, this is an issue that united in separate court filings Republicans in Congress and President Obama and the White House. I know you're here to talk about religion mainly, and not an expert on politics, but what do you make of this?
Well, it's something that the left and the GOP can align on some level, but I'm still kind of working that out on my own. I think the Obama administration has been an administration that wants to promote freedoms on many different levels that have been denied folks in this country. So from that standpoint, I get it. And it's easy to see why in this particular debate around Christianity, why those on the right would be in alignment, because those on the right tend to be those who align with evangelical Christianity in this country. And let's be clear here, evangelical Christianity kind of rules the day in terms of how we understand Christianity in this country. So I find it interesting, this so-called alignment around this issue, but I don't think we're at the end of this. I think it's as it plays itself out, we'll see some of those lines drawn yet again.
Derek, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was Derek Hicks, Assistant Professor of Religion and Culture at Wake Forest University's School of Divinity.
Coming up, we'll learn why Seymour is the home of the hamburger. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Tomorrow, the city of Seymour, Wisconsin, is celebrating their annual Burger Fest. This year's theme is a quarter century of quarter-pound burgers.
Seymour is the birthplace of the hamburger, depending on who you talk to, and they celebrate accordingly with this festival each and every year.
Today, we're talking to John Steltz, who is Hamburger Charlie for Seymour. John, thanks for being with us. Now, why is Seymour considered the home of the hamburger?
Seymour is considered the home of the hamburger because back in 1885... A young man of 15 years old named Charlie Negrin decided at the Outagamie County Fair to take a meatball, flatten the meatball, and put it in between two slices of bread so people could walk around and look at the exhibits and visit the animal barns and things like that and enjoy their meatball, now made into a hamburger.
So he lives on in legend, I hear.
Yes, he does live on in legend, and there have been a few Hamburger Charlies over the years here in Seymour. Because we are the home of the hamburger, there's actually a statue of Hamburger Charlie right downtown Seymour on the festival grounds where we will be having Burger Fest here tomorrow. And each year we have a gentleman like myself dress up as Hamburger Charlie used to dress up and go around and greet people and welcome people to Seymour for Burger Fest.
So what does he mean to Seymour? It seems like, if I recall correctly, there's a huge statue of him just right on the main drag there.
There is a huge statue of Hamburger Charlie. And what does it mean to Seymour? Well, when I was first asked about if I was interested in becoming Hamburger Charlie, I thought, wow, this is exciting. What an honor that I would even be thought of to represent. And I went to bed that night, and as I was laying in bed having trouble falling asleep, all I could think about was how Hamburger Charlie, not John Stelz, but how Hamburger Charlie is almost more important than the mayor of the town. So
wow.
after some strong consideration, I decided it would be a great opportunity to help give back to our wonderful community in Seymour and to represent Seymour and Burger Fest as home of the hamburger, and take on the character of Hamburger Charlie.
Why is he more important than the mayor?
Well, because everybody identifies Seymour as the home of the hamburger and identifies Hamburger Charlie as being a staple of that town. And so I think that there are many, many times where, you know, that this is an important position held because we're welcoming people from all over the country into Seymour for Burger Fest to celebrate the home of the hamburger. And we need that liaison. We need that Hamburger Charlie and to welcome these people in and to make them comfortable. And really, I mean, when you talk about history, you're talking about something that this community, that this state values. And Hamburger Charlie is the face of that. And not only was Charlie McGreen the originator of it, but Hamburger Charlie continues on that legend as the face of this wonderful invention and this wonderful history we have right here in our state. So that is kind of important.
Do you have responsibilities throughout the year, or is it just Burger Fest is the big moment for you?
Well, Burger Fest is the big moment, and one of my concerns when I was deciding to represent Seymour and be Hamburger Charlie, one of my concerns was I have a young family, and I wanted to do it right, and I didn't want to be missing out on what my kids were doing, but yet I wanted to be able to do this right for our community. And Burger Fest is the big moment, and leading up to Burger Fest is can be somewhat time-consuming here and there. But I can adjust my schedule, and I can make plans. And as long as I'm given enough time to plan, I usually can accommodate most situations where Hamburger Charlie is needed.
Who decides who's going to be Hamburger Charlie, and how were you chosen?
Well, there is a big secret board of members that gather around, I'm certain campfire and so forth, and they throw names in a hat and they pull one out. And no, I'm just kidding. but the process, there were applications. I think there were a few people who wanted to be Hamburger Charlie. I was asked by one of the board members. The Home of the Hamburger is actually a group of people in Seymour that put on the Burger Fest and everything else that surrounds Burger Fest and does a lot for our community. And I was approached by one of the board members who asked if I would be interested in doing it. And as I said, it took some time and some consideration to say, absolutely, yes, I'll do it, because I have other commitments in my life. But I think you need somebody who is, willing to talk with people, who's willing to welcome people into Seymour, who's willing to embrace the history of the invention of the hamburger, and I think that you have to have someone who's comfortable, you know, talking with the media and things like that. And I think that because of what I do in my job as a teacher and my involvement in the community besides the home of the hamburger, I think that led them to my door, and eventually I accepted. And this is my second year now being the Hamburger Charlie for Burger Fest.
Hmm. Well, I have to ask you this. There's another community that claims to be the home of the hamburger. I'm sure you get this question a lot. Athens, Texas claims to also have invented the hamburger there. A man named Fletcher Davis apparently did so, according to them. Is there Hamburger Fletcher, and do you guys have to duke it out once in a while?
I've never had the opportunity to duke it out, and considering the fact that they're from Texas, you know, it might be a high noon showdown sometime. Although, I would be willing to duke it out on the grill. I mean, if they're interested in a high noon showdown, maybe it's fire up two grills and see who can make the best hamburger. But all kidding aside, I mean, Seymour is the home of the hamburger. It's recognized as the home of the hamburger. The Wisconsin State Legislature a few years ago proclaimed Seymour, Wisconsin as the home of the hamburger. And we have documentation that goes back to 1885, documentation in the forms of newspaper articles, in the forms of photographs. All of these things are on display at the museum, the Seymour Historic Museum, right downtown Seymour, on the burger grounds, on the Burger Festival grounds. All of these documents are on display there. So they go back to 1885, and there is no other community that can claim that their origins go back to 1885.
Hmm. Yeah, and in Texas, they have an approximation of the late 1880s, so you might have edged them out by a couple of years then.
Well, that's true, and again, you go with the approximation. We have dates of 1885. We have articles from the Outagamie County Fair that was happening that year and so on and so forth. So we have the documentation to back up our claim that Seymour, Wisconsin is definitely, without a doubt, the home of the hamburger.
Well, and you're celebrating that tomorrow at the 25th Annual Burger Fest. Can you tell us what to expect there tomorrow?
There is something for people of all ages. We have the 5K bun run, which starts off tomorrow morning for the adults and for the older runners. We have a kids bun run later on in the morning, right before the world's largest hamburger parade. And the world's largest hamburger parade begins at 11 a.m. And following the parade, at noon, the festival grounds open, and we go from noon to 9 o'clock on the festival grounds right downtown Seymour. And to get into the festival, it's $5 at the gate, but it's $3 for a button in advance. So today would be your day to get it in advance. And then in the evening at Rockledge Park, we have a hot air balloon rally. And, of course, that is a beautiful sight if you've never been able to be a part of that. That is actually occurring this evening as well. It starts Friday night where they have, if weather permitting, the hot air balloons will ascend, and then they'll all come back, and at dusk they'll glow, which is awesome for the kids and all the families. And that is free of charge. And that, again, like I said, happens tomorrow night. But on the grounds we have bands, and we have burgers, of course. We have a Hardee's thick burger eating contest to see how many burgers you can eat in 10 minutes. We have a ketchup slide that is a hot attraction for so many people. It's like the old slip and slides from when we were kids, where you put the water on the slide and take a running start and see how far you can go. Well, instead of water, we put ketchup on this thing and take a running start and you take a head first dive and you try to set a new world record.
How messy.
Yeah, it is messy. And we have hoses to hose people down when they hop off the ketchup slide.
Great. Well, lots to do tomorrow, and people can learn more at homeofthehamburger.org, it looks like.
That is correct.
Thank you so much for being here.
It's been my pleasure, and we hope to see all of you out in Seymour this weekend.
That was John Steltz. He's Hamburger Charlie in Seymour, Wisconsin.
Coming up Monday on Central Time, we'll talk to a guest who says the Western is losing the interest of American moviegoers, but we need Westerns now more than ever.
We'll talk to a popular mechanics writer who's asking, do we still need car dealerships in this country? You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, 13.5% of Hispanic female students in grades 9 through 12 have admitted attempting suicide.
Some studies even show that 17% of all Latina adolescents in New York are actively considering suicide.
That makes Latina girls the most at-risk group among their peers for suicidal thoughts and attempts.
Our guest, Dr. Lydia Prado, noticed this trend in Denver, Colorado. She launched a program there called Voz y Corazón to help Latina girls with mental health issues. She's here with us now to talk about the challenges facing the community. Dr. Lydia Prado is the Director of Child and Family Services at the Mental Health Center of Denver. Lydia, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, Rob. Appreciate it.
So we heard a couple statistics there. What led you to found the Voz y Corazón program?
Well, at the time, this was back in 2004, the state of Colorado had one of the highest rates in the country. I believe we were ranked 7th. And so that just brought to my attention kind of our riskiness as a state. And then when I dug deeper, it looked like the trends here in Colorado were matching the national trends. And that for the girls between the ages of 11 and 17, there was a particular risk for young Latina youth. And I had some partners that were working in the community that were pretty invested in trying to switch that trend. So decided there was an opportunity from the Colorado Trust, a grant opportunity, and we just decided to go for it and enlist the help of young women to develop a program that would work for them.
We'll get into how this works in a bit, but first, we've had a lot of attention lately, I think, to suicide across the United States, but why Latina girls, why younger Latina women as a particularly high-risk group?
Well, when I talk to them and when we do surveys and a lot of outcome work with these young women and their families, and I think one of the things that increases risk for them is their sort of acculturation stress is what we would call them, and struggle. So they have a home culture that is quite valuable when we look at the literature, but at the same time, they are struggling to belong to the majority culture. So they change enough that they're not quite 100% fit with the home culture, and at the same time, they're not quite accepted fully in the majority culture. There's still some stereotypes quite active and some discrimination that they feel they're dealing with, and so they kind of present this as being sort of stuck in between. And when we talk about, we've come to talk about this as living in the borderlands, where you're not, it's like you don't have two fully valued feet in either world. And that just adds added stress onto being a teenager and the regular challenges of youth.
That's been an experience faced by second-generation immigrants across American history. Is this an immigration issue, or is there something different for the Latina community?
You know, it's interesting because when you look at when we work with young women who are first generation, there's a lot of protection there, meaning they're not nearly as much at risk as second and third, and there's something about the acculturation process itself that is making this risky. So it's like the longer this particular group is here, the unhealthier it gets in many ways, both with physical health and mental health. And most folks, when you look at kind of social determinants of health, it's a lack of access to education. They're in neighborhoods that aren't particularly healthy. So there are just a lot of internal and external variables that contribute to this.
Well, I wonder if the girls, the young women we're talking about, they're encountering these problems, do they have any kind of access to help? Is that part of the problem?
That is part of the problem. There isn't as much access to them, and I think across the country we know there is differential access to care. And so that is an issue. And even when they can access systems, sometimes those systems are not responsive to maybe perhaps their experiences and worldviews. So there's not a lot of trust, I would say, with the institutions that are meant to support and help young people and their families.
And so what you're trying to do, as you mentioned earlier, is to have the young women in this situation help one another. How does that work?
Sure. Well, let's take a quick step back. In developing the program, I got together about 40, 11 to 17-year-old girls and their teachers and other interested community members and walked through a strategic planning process. And what they were saying is that, and I hear this all the time anyway over the last 10 years, is that young people are intervening with young people anyway. If you and I are in eighth grade and I'm thinking of hurting myself or hurting somebody else, I'm telling my friends first. And not only am I telling my friends, I'm telling my friends they can't tell anybody else. Mm-hmm. So they were kind of stuck in terms of not knowing, getting the pleas for help and the disclosures and then not knowing what to do about it. So part of what we do is we train all these young people about how to listen, what to look for, and how to ask the tough questions. Are you thinking of hurting yourself? Have you thought about killing yourself? Do you have a plan? And then teaching them how to get who to go to for help and how to make a referral and how it's a good thing not to keep this a secret. We talk about what we call codes of silence a lot and how that might not be keeping their friend and or themselves healthy. So we offer trainings about 6 times a year, and if they go through it once and they want to do the training again, they can do that. So they can get a lot of exposure to how to help in ways that are effective from the program.
As you said, these are hard things to talk about for anybody. Is there something in, I guess, the culture of the community you're working with that makes people even more reluctant? Is there an extra stigma that beyond what we have in the rest of American culture?
You know, there seems to be stigma across the board, but there is an element of being a group that is different in the sense that they're supposed to take care of all of this within the group and at home and not expose the issues and problems to a larger community, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So that is a barrier in terms of we're supposed to be able to handle this. And if we let anybody know that we're having these struggles, they're going to look at us, like we're even more of a burden than they already believe we are.
How does another thing we've heard about across our culture lately is a lot of talk about bullying. How does that fit into Latina suicide rates?
You know, I think it fits for all young people. It's an element of distress. And I think it's hard for us sometimes as adults to realize just how different it is with technology and cyberbullying and how quickly negative things can be said and disseminated. And how that feels to a young person who, is feeling overwhelmed by that. It's different in magnitude, and it's different in frequency, and it's much harder. It's much harder to handle the magnitude and frequency if you end up being a target, in cyberbullying, or it just takes bullying to an extreme level. And it does impact these young people in ways that we haven't seen before.
Is part of the work you do helping people deal with the bullying and whether mm-hmm. they're the victim or part of the larger community?
Yeah, so part of the program is they meet with a mentor every week, and they meet in the same place, the same amount of time with the same person, and they also meet with an artist, because a big part of this is how to heal through creative expression. But in those weekly meetings, the young people are encouraged to talk about whatever challenges they're having and to get support in coping with those situations. So we hear everything from family situations to peer situations, boyfriend, girlfriend, school teachers, they can bring those issues there and get support. But I got to say, the one piece of feedback that I continually get is that they don't feel alone. Like they didn't realize they weren't the only person that has felt this way. I realize I'm not alone. I realize there's a place to belong. So it really, I think if I were to identify a core element, is that developing a sense of belonging to a group that cares about them is huge.
And you've seen this success story a lot as you've worked with this program over the years, that people are telling you they've seen this change, they see this connection now?
Yeah, and the young people tell us, but the people that work with the young people tell us, the folks that see the growth and, wow, this person has changed so much. They used to be so, you know, isolated, and now they're sharing their opinions, and they're talking, you know, with others. And we tend to ask, when they first join the program, you know, a list of strengths and kind of challenges. And at the end of the program, typically there's an increase in strengths and a decrease in what's bothering them. And they also report using the skills that they learn in terms of helping a neighbor, a friend, or a family member get the help when they need it. And the sad thing, though, is whenever I ask, the young people that we work with, their proximity to suicide, so questions like, do you know somebody, has a friend, has a family member attempted and or completed suicide, at least a third of them answer that question yes. Hmm. So we're working with the right group. This is good news. The sad news is that there's that much of it going on.
All right. Dr. Lydia Prado, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for the invitation. Appreciate it.
It's Dr. Lydia Prado, Director of Child and Family Services at the Mental Health Center of Denver. She's the founder of Voz y Corazón.
Coming up, NBC and CNN are both producing specials about Hillary Clinton. But should they? Our guest says no. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. At the end of July, both NBC and CNN announced plans to release separate projects focusing on Hillary Clinton. NBC plans a miniseries on Clinton's life, and CNN Films is planning a full-length cinematic release of a documentary.
Now, neither outlet plans to involve their network's news division in the effort, but they're both feeling some heat. Reince Priebus, Republican National Committee chair, is urging both networks to cancel the planned programs.
Joining us to talk about the issue is Jeremy Holden, Research Director of Media Matters. Media Matters says their mission is to correct conservative misinformation in the U.S. media, but this time they find themselves on the same side of this issue as the RNC. Jeremy, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So your progressive organization agrees with the RNC on this issue.
Well, we think what the RNC's statement and the pressure that they're bringing, the scrutiny that they're bringing to CNN and NBC, it illustrates why it's a bad idea to pursue these projects. It's the exact type of reaction that can be anticipated when these entities decide that they want to try to tap into what they expect is going to be a Hillary Clinton campaign for the White House. They want to capitalize on that through their entertainment divisions, but it creates blowback. And so what we think is that what the position that the RNC has taken is the exact type of blowback that could have been anticipated, and it should give pause to these networks as they consider pursuing these projects.
Right. Well, so let's set the stage a little bit. These two networks are making a couple of productions here, and that has started somewhat of a firestorm. But let's explain the reason why people are upset. Let's start with the RNC. What are their concerns?
Well, what the RNC has said is that they don't trust necessarily that these are going to be that this could give Hillary Clinton a leg up if she does decide to pursue the White House. And what they're saying is that if they go forward with this, then the RNC won't participate in debates on these channels. And so, you know, NBC is actually in this untenable position that, the news division is now acknowledging, right? We heard this week Chuck Todd and Andrea Mitchell saying that this is basically a nightmare for NBC News, that it's impossible for them to escape as a news division any type of scrutiny. You can imagine that as the miniseries comes close, Diane Lane, who's been mentioned as a possible lead in this project, it's not hard to imagine her being invited on the Today Show to promote this. That type of crossover creates serious problems that NBC News personalities are starting to recognize and speak to.
From the viewer's perspective, let's talk a little bit about demographics, I suppose. How many people are the typical viewers of presidential debates, and are they also going to be, I guess, more or less predisposed to actually watch the biopic?
So, you know, I think the issue is going to be one of placement, right? I mean, you would imagine that I think the entertainment side of NBC probably does get more viewers than the news side of it. The problem becomes the type of pressure that NBC is under. We already see voices on the right that are pressuring NBC to cover their kind of favored Clinton-era scandals, what they think were the big scandals of the 90s, things that have been investigated and found to have been a whole bunch of nothing. We're seeing pressure put on these networks to inflate those back to what the right wants them to be. It's really a situation that NBC and CNN, they can't avoid. So I think you're right that there would be a larger audience for say, a bio miniseries, but that doesn't mean that it's a good decision, and it doesn't mean that the NBC news side won't get tainted if the entertainment division moves forward.
Well, let me ask you this. Have you heard at all whether or not anyone from the editorial divisions of these networks will have a hand in the fact-checking and sort of the judgment calls that might be made by the producers of these specials?
So it's not clear to me at this time what that's going to be. I mean, NBC has tried to stand behind what's known as a firewall, right? That there's the entertainment division is separate from the news division. These are separate projects, and there won't be that type of overlap. But think about this a different way. If NBC's right that Hillary Clinton does decide to mount a campaign for the White House, there will be other candidates at play. How is NBC going to respond to pressure that they're giving all of this kind of free airtime, free advertising to Hillary Clinton? So does the Marco Rubio campaign, if that happens, do they then demand that they get four nights of primetime viewership? Even if NBC has a good faith effort to say that that's not a proper reading of fair time, they're going to have to respond to it. It really puts them in a tough spot.
Let me ask you, would you feel as concerned about a feature on Hillary Clinton if, say, NBC and CNN were devoting equal resources and airtime to someone like Chris Christie or another GOP favorite?
I think the problem remains the same, that once these networks decide to make a play at ratings based on this event, right? NBC is calling this kind of event programming. It becomes immediately problematic for the news division because the news side of both of these channels, if it's Chris Christie, if it's Marco Rubio, obviously if it's Hillary Clinton, which we're talking about, they still have to cover these people. Does the viewer separate the two, that you now have a financial interest in this campaign moving forward, in its success or its failure or how it's portrayed, and now the news side has to cover this objectively? I think it becomes very difficult for viewers to buy that firewall is in play and that these commercial interests that now creep into it don't also play a role.
What could the networks do proactively to reiterate the proverbial wall between the editorial half of their operation and the creative half? Is there anything they can do to restore confidence in their viewers?
I think it's going to be really hard to capitalize on this event programming that they're pursuing and assure viewers that that firewall exists. And you hear that in the comments of Chuck Todd and of Andrea Mitchell, who are saying that there's no way. I think what Chuck Todd said is we get all of the stain and none of the gain. We only get negative reaction from this. On the NBC News side, NBC Entertainment probably gets the glory, but the NBC News division only gets the criticism. I think that's why you start to hear those voices speaking out critically about the decision to run on NBC side to run that miniseries. CNN has been a little bit more quiet about it, but I think the same issues remain, that it's only negative press that falls on the news side when these projects go forward.
Do you think that these biopics and or this documentary might harm a candidate like Clinton, perhaps because of overexposure? Are voters and viewers going to burn out on Clinton before she even has a chance to declare that she's running?
See, and it's too soon to tell, and it's impossible to know. But here's another question that goes to the fact that NBC and CNN are really poking at a hornet's nest right now, and I think they have to be asking themselves, is this worth it, to pursue it? Because it's the more you start to explore the conflicts at play, the conflicts inherent in these decisions, the more questions and concerns that pop up.
And Well, we have to go to news soon, but we'll continue this conversation on the other side. Maybe we'll take a look at some of the lessons learned from a failed 2003 effort to bring a Ronald Reagan miniseries to CBS and what we can learn from that today and some other issues surrounding this. We're talking with Jeremy Holden. He's a research director of Media Matters about a controversy stirring up around a couple of planned TV specials focusing on Hillary Clinton.
We'll continue our discussion with Jeremy coming up after a break, and we'll be taking your calls. What do you think of this? Do you think the networks made a bad decision to produce and air these films? Do you think it'll reflect poorly on their news operations? Is this partisan? Does it blur the lines between entertainment and politics? Should they back off?
You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@WPR.org, or feel free to leave us a message on the Central Time Facebook page. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Later on in the show, we'll look at community-supported arts, a new effort to bring art into our daily lives. Stick around. There's more to come after the news on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.